Welcome to the Critical Digital Pedagogy Podcast. In this podcast, Howard Scott and Samar Jarrad talk about developing a paradigm shift in Palestinian teaching and learning practice. Okay, welcome Howard, welcome Samar. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a few questions about the chapter, obviously. Just for a little bit of context, can you just tell us what your jobs are and where you work as well? So, Howard, can I ask you just to kick off, first of all?
I'm Howard Scott. I'm in the post-compulsory teacher education team at the University of Wolverhampton. So my role is principally sort of, don't like to use the word training, educating teachers to join the sector, vocational and technical sector in Britain. And besides that, I also have kind of research allocation in my role. So research in literacies and learning technologies and things around adult community learning.
Okay, can I ask the same question to you, Samar? So what's your job and where do you work?
Yeah, well, sure. So my introduction is going to be a little bit less sophisticated than that Dr. Howard. So I'm going to start by my name. My name is Samah Jarrad. I am still at the beginning of my PhD journey. I'm a PhD student candidate at the UKM University in Malaysia, and I am an instructor of English language at Palestine Technical University Khaduri. It's a university located in Tulkarem city in Palestine. It's in the northern part of Palestine, basically, and it's the only state university in Palestine. This is the quality that really stands out when you talk about Khaduri.
I'm based in Britain. I know what the context is for education in Britain, but people are listening to this podcast will be conscious of, you know, the situation in Palestine. But my next question is really directed to you, Samar. Can you tell us how the situation in Palestine is actually affecting students and general teaching at your universities?
Well, yeah, sure. The general political situation in Palestine, which is quote unquote occupation, is very much affecting all life aspects, including education. So everything becomes more challenging for people, including education. So, for example, things that are taken for granted elsewhere, the likes of freedom of mobility, the likes of the freedom or the right to having a secure teaching environment, the learning environment are not present in Palestine. So when talking about freedom mobility, everything is bound with the political situation here. So whenever we have skirmishes between the Palestinians and the Israelis, a checkpoint might be installed, students might be delayed, the classes might be deferred, classes might be cancelled even, and it's never safe to go to school. It's never safe to move between cities. So, you never know when Israeli soldiers are going to storm into the university's campus. And I've actually witnessed this firsthand. Some people might think that this was back in the Intifada days, but unfortunately, we're still facing these kinds of things. Students might be arrested from inside the university campus. The students' council's properties might be vandalized. Things might be confiscated. So basically, it's a risk to do anything here. And education is obviously included in this kind of risk.
What I want to do now is turn more to the chapter. So my next question is directed maybe more towards Howard. The chapter is based around the TEFL EPAL project, which is funded by Erasmus. Can you tell me more about this project and basically what were the aims?
The Erasmus project was covers about 3 years, and we started it. It's kind of cross-national search involved in 15 Palestinian institutions, HEIs, and then there's a Turkish partner, and a German university, and ourselves, and then there's an Irish and a Spanish presence as well. And everybody has different roles, and I think our role was as kind of developing training, developing training materials. The funding was to, I guess, to transform language learning in the Palestinian APIs, using digital technology to create more, I guess, more dynamic teaching and learning processes, more interactive, and utilizing sort of social technologies, social pedagogies. And so that incorporated ourselves as bringing sort of training knowledge, teacher education knowledge. The Turkish University in Andalus was, they're kind of computer science, so they're generating a source bank for materials. And the German University is, they're linguistic specialists. So everybody brings different kind of domains of knowledge, and there's a huge investment of funds into the HEIs to develop kind of learning labs and innovate with their teaching practice. As we all know, you know, the hardware isn't actually the most essential thing. You know, so what you choose to spend the money on, I guess, for each organisation is down to them. But to our mind, you know, in teaching and learning using mobile is as effective, I guess, as having a home computer or a laptop. In Palestine, about developing capacity and infrastructure as well as knowledge and skills of pedagogical.
I think that's a really good description of what the project is about. You know. Thanks for that. So when you were involved in this project, and I think we talk about this in the chapter as well, from a British university perspective, how did you approach the project? Were you very conscious about bringing your values to this project?
That's a difficult balance to strike, I think. We're led by Professor John Traxler, who's kind of lead investigator. And I think he stressed straight from the start, you know, that we aren't coming to sort of lead or tell or, you know, point in direction. We're very open-minded to listen. We realise that all cultures and contexts are different, so every educational context is culturally specific, and that must be preserved and enriched and promoted here. So although we come with certain values, we aren't dictating those at all, and we're very careful in our work. When Matt Smith and myself went to Ramallah in 2019 for a week, we were very careful that anything that we were involved in wasn't determining the context from our point of view. We were really kind of, wherever we had like one specific workshop session where we were very mindful that it was important to be cooperative and to listen and to learn and to, you know, create kind of consensus across even the, you know, institutions there involved in these huge meetings we had, that each of those has a different kind of context. Each of those has different sets of values, different understanding, different approaches to education, and each teacher in a department. So we were trying to create a set of consensus to define our kind of universal approach amongst all of us as a philosophical framework, if you like, a shared set of values, which I explain in the chapter, and that came completely from all of the local institutions and teachers, as it needed to be.
Okay, Brilliant. Thanks, Harold. Can I again ask a similar question to you, Samar, as well? Had you worked with Howard and the University of Wolverhampton before? And did you have any expectations of working with a British university?
Well, actually, this was my first collaboration with a British university and a British colleague. And, well, I was a little bit apprehensive at first. I mean, I'm still, as I said at the beginning, I'm still commencing my PhD journey, and I was very apprehensive that I'll be dealing and interacting with colleagues who are much more well-established in the field, knowledge-wise. And, of course, I'll be dealing also, I was, like, very apprehensive because I would be dealing with native speakers of the language who had well-established years of writing and researching and doing all these things that I had really no prior experience in. But I was pleasantly surprised with the way they approached it. I mean, Professor Howard put it really really well when he said that they were trying to build some sort of a philosophical framework that would unify all of us. I mean, I did not feel in any way less than, say, a British professor. Knowledge-wise, of course, there was still this difference, but they were imparting the knowledge in a way that was very, very friendly, very easy to comprehend, and very easy really to develop upon our skills and knowledge that we already had.
In terms of working at the Palestinian University, can you describe the existing methods of teaching? I know the project is, I mean, the intention of the project was to sort of move or create, I mean, in your words, a paradigm shift, really. What were you trying to move away from?
To make things clearer, I would start by emphasizing the situation as it was, especially I'm stressing pre-COVID times, because, I mean, everything is different now and we've shifted completely to online education. So the situation as it was, we actually had classes in a very much traditional set. So the classes that we had were very much teacher oriented. They were like lectures in the literal sense of the word. So the professor would impart the knowledge that he had or that she had, and then the students were actually passive listeners. After each class, we would ask the students to fill out some sort of a questionnaire regarding their achievement and how they found the subjects that they were taught. And every time we handed the questionnaire, we had the same results. The students always complained that they were not getting the information or the knowledge that they have set their hearts in when they enrolled in the courses. So, but unfortunately, there was nothing to move away from the traditional exam-based teaching methods. And, of course, this was also a problem because we had senior faculty members who opposed shifting to blended learning or teaching that was more or less student-oriented. And with the project, this has really changed. And, in fact, some of the most adamant professors who had actually refused the idea of shifting or incorporating aspects of technology into teaching were themselves coming up with ideas and telling the students to go do this, do that, give us your suggestions. So, I mean, the results were really amazing, and the students, the preliminary surveys, I would say, have showed that the students have actually really got the knowledge that they have really wanted when they first enrolled in the courses. So I would say based on the results of the surveys, prior and post the implementation of the program, the students have really gotten the supposed ILOs of the course that they were being taught.
That sounds great. So the project talks about scaling up project-based learning. There's maybe a question directed to, I don't know, first maybe Howard and then Sam, if you want to chip in as well. So what did this actually mean, this concept of project-based learning, and how did you go about it?
I think, to my mind, project-based learning fits with the kind of transformation that we're trying to initiate. I think we have to recognise that that's really an impossible task to transform a teaching and learning culture, because there's so many different influences on that, from the curriculum design to leadership to capacity of the teachers and the learning outcomes and agenda that you're setting. So this was a way of kind of introducing it at a classroom level. Something that's just simply very dynamic, very participatory, as teaching and learning has to be. Much more reflective of students' lives, I think, and that was part of our philosophical framework, which is this, whatever we're trying to transform the education system in language learning to look like, whatever we want to turn it into, it has to celebrate Palestinian heritage and culture. So my advice was, this is structured around the students' own lives and their capacity to have agency, to act upon the world, to share their kind of world, and utilize, there's definitely a space for all types of learning strategies. So there may be some very kind of teacher-led instruction, direct instruction, or front-of-room style teaching from a textbook. There is a place for that, for sure. But the application of languages in practice is where I think project-based learning comes into its forte, because you have opportunities for, communication that's very personalised, presented in a variety of different ways, and really kind of fits with the kind of social technologies that I think have a place in these teaching and learning contexts. So I guess it was Summer who, scaffolded, structured the whole program, but I guess project-based learning is done over a series of sessions, planned and implemented, and it followed, I think, a brief that we created, maybe you want to get to here. But there's no prescription from our point of view at all. It's theoretically sort of suggested and then enacted by practitioners in the country, of course.
Yeah, the chapter talks about a couple of really good examples, actually, especially in terms of a couple of the assignments that were set. There was a couple of assignment briefs that you talked about. Summer, were you involved with those assignments?
They were implemented on a class that I was teaching. And they were very well received. I even incorporated this in my post-COVID experience, in my online experience, because it's not that difficult to implement, and the results that have actually come out from implementing these briefs were brilliant. The students, they really had fun. My students were given a task of presenting an aspect that they really liked about their culture. So whether they choose a place, a traditional dish, a ceremony, something that they are really inclined to cover and to discover more, and to invite other people to try. And the good point or the advantage that I had is that the students in this course specifically were journalism students. So they were already glued to their cell phones. They were already well established in the world of social media. And Dr. Howard suggested that I take this as an entrance for the students to be creative and to tackle and to combine something that they really enjoyed and liked with language. And as I said, students were asked to tape videos, to even create posters, to create Instagram pages that would promote aspects of their lives, the likes of tourism. Some students videotaped Eid ceremonies, others videotaped Ramadan ceremonies. Some of the students created an Instagram picture, an Instagram a profile that encouraged tourism to his favorite place in Palestine. And as I said, the results were amazing because, I mean, as in all classes in the universe, some students would be described as shy, passive, a little bit laid back. And because the tasks that I've assigned were basically collaborative, I found that this had really good impact on the learning process because, I mean, students were doing something that they loved, something that they enjoyed, and they were unconsciously learning the language. So I was flooded and bombarded with messages on Facebook and on Instagram. They were asking me, what's the meaning of this word? How can I translate this? I've tried to translate this, but I can't find an equivalent. How can I replace this? So I was really happy with the interaction process and with the end result because, I mean, at the end, they were not perfect, of course. But there was a paradigm shift. This is the correct way to describe it. There was like a very much a paradigm shift between what they started as and how they ended up being. So they would stand up in front of everybody, explain, talk about their projects. And they were even talking about a bigger idea. They wanted to participate in a conference and stuff. But unfortunately, with COVID, this was not possible. But still, I mean, after COVID, I started to ask students to do smaller things, you know, things in your garden, things that you really like in your garden, things that are very much hands-on and feasible to everybody.
How did that fit with your department there, you know, your approach to the curriculum? There was obviously flexibility enough in the first place that you could introduce something like that into your classroom and your scheme of work, you know, over a few weeks, that you could bring something like that in and change the teaching to do something new. Was that well received by the department?
Well, I would say it was well received amongst the younger staff members. But I mean, it's always a challenge because when you we have some sort of a generational gap, so we're kind of divided in the department. I'm talking about our department. So the new staff members who are young and very much attached to the world of social media and kind of have an interface with what's life like now. They were very much up for it, and they welcomed because we needed to have a consensus, but we were not able to reach that. So we decided to go with the majority. So I would say the majority of the faculty, were actually very much welcoming of the idea. But as like everywhere, and as with everything, we had some difficulties with the older staff members.
I think it's interesting how that plays out in time because, you know, we can't really stop these apps becoming tools of and resources of future teaching, you know, contemporary teaching. And very much, you know, if you want to change the culture, you change the teacher education, I believe. And you have kind of pioneers coming through who will do new things and inspire others, I think. And I think that's really important.
Yeah. Thanks, Summer. You gave some really great examples there. And mentioned, that was going to be my next question, really, was about what tools you were using. But I can see straight away that, you know, things like Facebook and Instagram and so on.
Instagram, YouTube, yeah. Posters, even, yeah.
Okay, great. Okay, it sounds a really good example of, you know, the types of things we're talking about in this book relating to critical digital pedagogy. You're bringing in, you can't but help bring in the outside world into your teaching and learning in this context, can you? It would be almost crazy not to. And through that, I can see how that's developed a sense of collaboration amongst the students and possibly amongst the staff as well. Okay, great. Thanks for that. I just want to end up with my final question, really. Is there anything else you want to mention about the chapter that I haven't touched on in terms of my questions?
I think one of the things that kind of asked about it before, about our values and transposing those and there being potential tensions there. And I'm, you know, as we go on, I get more wary of some of those big tools that, you know, some of the big software companies and social media companies that are starting to dominate, you know, the channels that we work through. And I think that has an enormous impact on the information that we share, but also, you know, the way that we communicate and it becoming a little bit homogenized, perhaps. You know, so things like Instagram, WhatsApp, YouTube, Facebook become the kind of go-to settings, don't they? And I think the next step is really sort of creating different tools or looking for different options of different tools to use.
Thank you very much both for this little conversation, and take care.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you for having us.
Okay.
Thank you. It was a very lovely meeting.
The book on which this podcast series is based, Critical Digital Pedagogy in Higher Education, Broadening Horizons, Bridging Theory and Practice, is edited by Susan Kosioglu, George Veloxianos and Chris Rowell, and is published by Athabasca University Press. Music is by BioUnit and is available on a Creative Commons license from the Free Music Archive at freemusicarchive.org. Thank you.